Hey everyone, welcome to this week's show. This is your host, Lisa Anderson. And a good and an interesting show this week because I actually didn't do a whole lot of it. I was out sick and the team had to step in on my behalf. Later on in the show, you'll see the inbox. Actually, you'll hear it. You won't see it, but you know, whatever. See with your ears. You'll hear the inbox where I talked to one of our counselors about getting over a crush. And then in our culture segment, Anthony and Martha had the chance to interview Andy Crouch, actually in Anthony's car. So you'll want to be present for that. That's a lot of fun. But basically on the whole idea of power, how do Christians use power? How does the world use power? What do we do with it appropriately based on Andy Crouch's book, Playing God. And then for the roundtable, they led that charge as well, a discussion of the culture, specifically being an influencer when it comes to the arts and Hollywood, people that are kind of in that sphere. What does that look like? And so Anthony and Martha are part of that discussion too. So I'm going to hand it over to them. Here we go.
Hello, Boundless Peeps. I'm Anthony Ashley, and I'll be your host for the roundtable this week. Sadly, Lisa is sick today and decided not to share her germs with us, so we are both sad and grateful that she's not here. Today, we're going to talk about Christians and culture. What is the Christian's place in the world's culture? Are we supposed to wage culture wars? Do we avoid culture as much as possible? Do we just blend in with culture, or is there another way? I've got three culture makers here with me in the studio who are going to help us talk through these questions. Jeremy, Chris, and our own Martha. Hello, friends.
Hello.
Hey, Anthony.
Hey.
Real quick, I want to kind of run through your respective CVs to get some context for this discussion. Jeremy Grant we have here, otherwise known as Jay Grant. He's a super talented graphic designer and fine artist who does assemblage or found object art. If you don't know what that is, assemblage is where the artist collects all kinds of objects that would otherwise be labeled as junk and incorporates them into really cool sculptures. Here in Colorado Springs, Jay Grant is a leader and connector in the arts community, and I actually had the pleasure of viewing his newest art show a couple nights ago, and it was awesome. Chris Hooper, otherwise known as Hoop, yes, to those who know him well, as a filmmaker, he's run the cultural gamut all the way from Hollywood to focus on the family, with foreign countries in between. He's worked with actors like Leo DiCaprio, Jodie Foster, and yes, Leslie Nielsen of Spy Hard fame. He produced and edited many documentary films and reality TV shows, and he also shot The Way the Master with Ray Comfort and Kirk Cameron, as well as working with folks in the family and making public service announcements and commercials and documentaries. Martha, otherwise known as the Krinkmeister.
That's a new one.
Martha Krinke comes from the writing, journalism, and media world, a fact we benefit from here at Boundless. You attended the World Journalism Institute. You were trained as to incorporate your Christian worldview with your journalism and worked in a mainstream newsroom for about a year before coming to focus on the family. So let's start with your own journeys. I'd like to hear your stories in a nutshell about what your current relationship with culture is and how you got here. Chris, tell us about how you got into Hollywood, what that was like for you, and where God has you today.
Well, I actually started out as a fine artist, like our friend over here. and I basically started working with a production designer that had me doing illustrations, storyboards, things like that, and then just started working on set as well, and ended up working, as a set dresser, and ended up on all these funny Japanese commercials where like big name actors were in them and stuff, which is funny. Jodie Foster or Leonardo
DiCaprio.
Awesome, so you're, on set, and basically in that position, you're just, you know, dressing sets, you're making it look pretty, you know, making sure that everything looks right for the shot. But I had a real desire to do more, you know, to do something that affected culture. And so I got involved and doing missionary trips. And I had gone to India and like got very sick for months and in a little hut in the in the mountains, and it was wild. And a young woman actually died in my arms. She drank poison because she didn't have enough money to pay for a dowry to get married. And there's so much of their value is based in marriage and all that. And so it was really traumatic. And yeah, no, came back and decided, we shot a bunch of video while we were there. And so I had never actually put together a documentary before, but I took that footage and turned it into something that I thought would touch people. And so ever since then, that's what I started doing. So I decided I want to do this full time. Not just work on sets, but actually affect culture and change the way people view people, and hopefully motivate Christians to do something to keep these young girls from killing themselves or other projects. You know, dealt with sexual exploitation of children or water issues in Africa, things like that.
Awesome, I love that. Change the way people look at people. That's that's awesome. Jay Grant. How did your heart for art, yes, that rhymed, develop? What's your mission in the art scene, and are you just trying to grow your own fame as an artist, or is there a bigger goal before you?
I mean, it's really all about fame and money.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
That's why you invited me on this, right?
Yeah, because artists make a lot of money.
You're kind of the devil's advocate in this discussion.
Like, two artists in the world make a lot of money, and the rest of them starve. I think, so art, and eventually kind of design, so graphic design, my day job, has always been something that I've kind of just gravitated toward naturally. You know, I was drawing pictures from way young and got in art lessons, and that was something that my folks really encouraged. And when I discovered I could actually make a living at it, I was really, really stoked about that. As I've been in it more, there is more of a sense of kind of, what am I doing here? What's the purpose in design and in the fine art stuff as well. And I think it's interesting because I think fine art typically is not something that's really that relevant to the average person. So the fine art world, museums, you know, you hear a lot of the kind of stories of, well, I mean, it's like a meme, right? Like, my 2-year-old could paint that kind of thing. Like, you go into the modern art museum and you see the white canvas or the black canvas, and it's like, did they just forget to paint this? Or and so a lot of people kind of dismiss fine art as being relevant to them, whereas on the design side, it's, you know, you see tons of design that people really resonate with, and especially kind of our generation. We have, you know, like Tom's and Sevenly, the t-shirt design company that benefits all kinds of different nonprofits and causes and that sort of thing. You see some of that stuff where they're really trying to change the world intentionally. And that's more on the design side. So where I'm kind of like in the middle somewhere. And at this point, I don't really have much of a platform. I'm very much an emerging artist. And so I'm kind of trying to figure out, who are the people that really resonate with my work? How can I speak to them best? And there's a part of that where I'm, you know, trying to be online, trying to build a digital presence. You know, I have a website, jeremygrantcreative.com.
Good plug.
Throw that out there. Shameless self-promotion.
Dub plug.
You know, trying to kind of feel that out. So I just had a show that opened actually this last Friday. And that show in particular is, I think, one of the more cohesive shows I've had. And one where I've, you know, really tried to kind of push a theme and a meaningful connection point through with the art. It's pretty abstract work, but I've done my best to help people kind of be guided through that experience. That's a big part of where I see fine art lacking in culture shaping, is not making the work accessible to their viewers. And so, in my mind, like, giving people even just like a paragraph, you know, 3 sentences, like, think about this idea while you look at the work, is hugely helpful.
It's awesome.
So
that's something I appreciate about your art, is it has that kind of instructive, not in a patronizing way, but just in like in a better way than that. So instructive and very theological, but also just kind of open to just feeling through the piece. Good stuff.
Yeah.
Martha, you've mentioned your struggles and experiences which you encountered while working in the secular news world. So what was that like there, and what did you learn?
Well, so I actually got my start in journalism in high school, working on the school paper, and then in college worked on the paper again. So when I finished school, it was kind of a debate of, do I go into another newspaper at some community, or do I pursue a magazine at Focus on the Family, which was my real dream. But that didn't happen right away, and so I was in a newspaper for a little while, and it was just, the diversity around me was quite shocking for this little girl that grew up in Christian schools and Christian family, and I didn't know how to handle it. There was one guy who was Jewish, there was another guy who was Lutheran, there was one girl I don't think was involved in any church, and I just felt like the oddball, truly, and it scared me, and I haven't gone back since. So I could have a little bit of a different perspective in this conversation, but I'm anxious to hear how it goes.
Cool. So. All right, so when thinking about culture, it can be easy to dehumanize the issue, and I think a necessary part of developing a good theology of culture is to recognize that our relationship with it is largely comprised of relationships with people. So tell me about your experiences working with people in film, art, journalism, media. These communities are typically stereotyped as godless. So what's challenging about that? What's good about that? Like, give me some personal stories.
I actually wrote an opinion piece once about my faith, and I did not hide it at all, or even... I guess I could have maybe been a little bit more smooth with it, but I got criticism on it, and it just made me think, well, I mean, it's felt like my faith had no place in my workplace. Mm. And so being such a huge part of me, that's where I think part of the conflict I felt was, okay, if I can't write about this, then I must not fit here. Forget it. But what was your guys' experience with that?
Yeah, I would say, like, in my work, I try to do things or make art based on themes that are specific to my experience, but broad enough that other people can relate. And so, like, my latest show, it was kind of around this idea of suffering and death and the life and the growth that comes through those things. So obviously the Christian idea of resurrection, but you know, you could be a naturalist evolutionary biologist and see a cycle of death and life and, you know, these sorts of things in evolutionary thinking as well. And it's like, that's something that anybody can relate to. I had a guy come up to me at the show, actually, and started talking to him, and he was asking me about a particular piece. He's like, I resonate with this piece, but I don't know why. Like, tell me about this piece. And so I told him about the theme of the show, and that piece in particular was, you know, it has like a kind of a silhouette of a strong man in one corner. It's like the only like figurative part of the piece. The rest of it is abstract, but this kind of man flexing his muscles in the corner. And the guy proceeds to tell me that he has just been through all of these difficult things in his life. He just went through a divorce, you know, but through these difficulties, you know, kind of relating to all this like chopped up wood and broken pieces in this piece of art, like all these difficulties, he feels like now there's a new horizon in front of him. And he has potential ahead of him. He's like, okay, I can put this stuff in the past and I can move forward. And he was like, actually being really vulnerable with me in the middle of this
awesome
gallery. You know, it's not at all the place that I would think of as safe for vulnerability. You know, it's just a straight up gallery. And he's telling me this story. And I was really blown away by that. Really honored, honestly.
Do you feel like that was just God at work? Wow, I don't know how that happened. Or is that approach that you take to your art that people can experience it and and interpret it for in their own lives?
I think it's both. I mean, I don't know if I'll ever see that guy again, but you know, I feel like I'm trying to create work in that kind of mindset of, I want people to be able to approach it, you know? So talking about the relationship aspect of culture making, I want to have a relationship with my audience.
Awesome.
Honestly, I think it's important that art makers like seek that out, because especially in music, if you're not developing a relationship with your audience,
yeah,
you're not going to survive, because yeah, people will listen for free to your music for 10 seconds and then not so connect with you. You know, same. It's the same thing with visual art, but it's a little different nuance to it.
Mm.
But I think you have to seek out that connection. So I think there's a part of it where it's like, I'm actually, as I'm creating, I'm, you know, I'm talking to the Father and asking for these kinds of things. But I also am just really intentional to try to work that in.
I think when I was in the newsroom, it was kind of like, here's the truth, take it.
Yeah, yeah.
Very forceful perspective.
Huh, yeah.
And I think a lot of that was just being young, and
right,
it was my first experience really out in the real world, and didn't know how to handle it. I think it would be different now of having had some life experience, and that focus on relationship was a great point.
Yeah. Awesome. I think that Christians make that mistake a lot, like especially in filmmaking. Mm. I see that they're very heavy-handed, which when you're trying to, I mean, it's okay to make a film that's just for Christians, but I think that the desire is to touch other people too, like, and to try to draw them in, but so often I think that we don't end up relating to the people that we're trying to reach, so it's, I think it's so important, you know, as a filmmaker, to be real, to be very real. The hard part is that sometimes people take it too far, and then you alienate Christians because, you know, you can't be so real that, you know, you show all the dirt, you know what I mean? And then at the same time, you have to be relatable to somebody that's not a Christian necessarily.
Sure.
So it is a fine balance that you're trying to walk in. I recently did a film called... I'm terrible with names. I do this every single time. sorry about that.
No
but
worries.
I recently did a film about a family that they were having a baby, and that baby wasn't going to live.
Hmm.
But they decided to have that baby anyway and honor that baby, and they gave it so much value. So I presented this film to the Burbank International Film Festival, and submitted it in the dramatic short category. It's called A Letter from Dad. Anyway,
there it is.
So it's basically
letterfromdad.com.
Yeah, I just remember the name. I'm terrible with names. Anyway, so on the spot at least.
Sure.
And,
sure.
We can put a link on our blog.
Yeah.
So people can see.
And so it's called A Letter from Dad, and it and I did do it for focus on the family, but basically the response I got from this person that was running the film festival was really interesting. He called me and said, "Is this real? Did this really happen?" And was very like worked up about it a little bit, not in a bad way. And I thought it was really interesting that he had to call me right away as soon as he saw it. It was like 10:30 at night.
Awesome.
And ended up being submitted into the film festival, and it was up against, you know, several other short films, because that dramatic shorts are their biggest category. So there's they had tons and tons of submissions in that category, and it made the film festival. Yeah, yeah.
The shorts.
Yeah,
I always go to.
Yeah, isn't it fun? you can see a lot of stuff really fast.
Yeah, man.
But they ended up. He ends up, you know, submitting. He went ahead and submitted in that category. Later, I found out they had a Christian category, which I didn't even know they had.
Yeah.
It was like the first time having it or something, and so. But when he. But then it ended up getting nominated for Best Dramatic Short in the Fantastic. Secular category. And
awesome.
And I think that the people connected with it because it wasn't heavy-handed, but it showed, it was just a real people. I mean, even though it was a dramatic reenactment, it was about real people that were, that just put so much value on this baby's life. Mm. That the mom would go through the whole process of having this baby just to have a few minutes. Like, I think it was that baby lived like 20 minutes or something. And so they had a few minutes with their baby, and that was so important to them, right? And mm-hmm. so when you see that, when you see somebody that puts great value on human life instead of just says, you gotta, don't abort babies, you know, like in angry.
Yeah.
But when mm-hmm. you see somebody that is that has so much heart and feelings towards this child that they would actually go through all this suffering to bring that mm-hmm. child to mm-hmm. forth, knowing that it's gonna die, that in itself is something that will cause people to go, wow. You know, this is, these people really believe this. These people believe that life is important. And so I think you affect lives when you are real. And so that the Christian world has a hard time doing that sometimes. I don't know why exactly, but especially in films. And so I always love it when I see a Christian film that has some really great moments that the people feel really genuine and real, and it's not just trying to get to the point of where they can preach the gospel.
Awesome.
Because I think the gospel is really love. And if you can really show love for what it really is, then that will touch lives.
Man, that's a gorgeous story and a great example of the value or the importance of, as a Christian, doing your art, doing your craft extremely well. And not in a way that's necessarily combative or with an agenda, but just kind of putting like your best authentic work out there, and then mm-hmm. you know, people respond to that.
I think that's contagious.
Yeah.
You know, if you are, so there's this idea of, if you want to create work that is unique, you need to create work that is can only come from you, right? And so.
Yeah.
And it's not about like this kind of introspective belly button gazing, like my work is only for myself, you know, but there's the truth that your work can only come from you. And so finding that work that is uniquely you, that is real, it is authentic, and then doing your best to put that forward in a way that people can engage with, like that's contagious. And, you know, as opposed to, like you said, you know, telling people what they should or shouldn't do, it's like presenting, here's who I am, you know? And so from a gospel perspective, like here's how the gospel has changed me and here's who I am now. And, you know, I'm not who I was, and just being as real and authentic about that as you can.
Mm. Like, but Jeremy, that takes that. Vulnerability.
No! There's no place for that in galleries or film
but
festivals.
But I think that is a big challenge of, I mean, to put yourself out there, people could accept it or reject it. And that's, a scary thing.
Because back to the whole, you know, Jesus said, don't put your light under a bushel, which I think is a bucket. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So don't hide God's glory in you.
I think it's a
you.
Beard style, actually.
A beard style. That makes sense. I could have a light under my beard. Yeah. We each have like a specific expression of God's glory inside of us, and the world needs that to be revealed.
Yeah.
We are all out of time. Awesome talking with you guys. It's been enlightening, and I'm sure we could talk about this issue so much longer. So, for all of you listening, hopefully you think about this issue of your place in culture and have these conversations with your friends. Cheers. Feel like I'm staring at the sun, but I feel no pain. Got a feeling in my heart that I can't explain. These walls I've built, they all fall down for you. And it's a rush like the river that runs through. Get caught in your tide like I can't believe. You hold me like an open fire in you. And my heart beats loud like a thousand drums. Feel alive like the city where I come from. I've got a hole in my heart that I can't explain for you. And you set me on fire. Burn with your love. Hello, Boundless friends. This is Anthony Ashley. Martha and I have the privilege of being at the Redeeming Work Conference hosted by the Leadership Journal today. One of the conference speakers is our culture segment guest, and he was kind enough to join us in my hot car for this recording because we could not find a quiet place. His name is Andy Crouch, and he is the executive editor of Christianity Today. He's the author of several books, including Culture Making and Playing God, Redeeming the Gift of Power, the book that we'll be talking about today. To start off, Andy, you read about the theology of power, the gift of power, how it, you know, relates to Christians. Why should young adults today care about power, care about thinking about this topic?
Well, I find that a lot of people are very suspicious of power and often want to avoid having it or getting it. And when we see what people actually do with it once they get it, we become even more suspicious. But the problem, in a way, is that if you don't have power, you can't fruitfully change the world. To have power is to be able to make a difference in the world around you. That would be the most basic definition of power, the ability to act meaningfully in the world that you're in. And in fact, none of us can live without at least some power. Every one of us had the power to wake up this morning. Most of us were able to get out of bed. We were able to start our day. And that means we've been given some amount of ability to make something of the world. It actually turns out that that is the deepest meaning of power, the ability to make something of the world. And it's something every human being, I think, is meant to have. So it's not something that just powerful people have. It's actually something every human being has or is meant to have. And as you grow older, you will get more and more of it. And if you aren't prepared for that, it will start to distort your relationships, your work, your life. And so I think actually it helps to think about power when you're young, because you aren't already kind of caught up in all the ways power can become distorted. And instead, you're actually able to think about, who do I want to become as, you know, whether I become a parent, whether I acquire more responsibilities at work, whether I end up, God forbid, writing a book like I did. All these things add to your power, and you better be ready to think about how to handle them as a Christian.
That's a good word. So to that point of power that's not distorted power that is used well, in your book you say that power without love is meaningless, but love without power is less than it was meant to be. You want to say more about that?
Yeah. You know, when I'm a parent of two children, and part of my job as a parent actually is to use power in their lives. If I say to my children, Jesus didn't mean us to have power, I don't want to use power, that would actually mean withdrawing myself from their lives. Mm. When in fact, what we all need from the people who invest in us is that they invest their power in our lives. So we have to realize that power is actually made for flourishing. When power is used well, other people and indeed the whole creation flourish in a way they don't if we withhold our power. It's meant for other people's flourishing. Now, the problem with power is we tend to use it for our own flourishing. And so everything you're entrusted with, it could be money, it could be good looks, which you have and I don't. It could be, a sharp mind. It could be a particular talent. All those things, we can decide either to use the power we get because of those things to help ourselves flourish, or we can ask, how is this supposed to help other people flourish? That's the most basic decision about power. Who's going to flourish because I have it?
That's good.
Andy, as I was reading your book, I was just kind of thinking about the differences of like men and women and as it relates to power. And you talked about status and privilege, and I think there is something about being a man and power of making that association. I think women have power too.
Yes.
But how does that work with the two different genders?
I don't think there's any doubt that we are socialized from a very early age to use power differently. There are these amazing studies about how boys play together versus how girls play together. And boys play kind of looking to establish a pecking order where we figure out who gets to decide what game we play. Girls also, there's power in the way girls play as well, but it's much more about who can convince the group to cooperate rather than who can dominate. These are in the studies of how children play. Now, in fact, when we grow up, we acquire both ways, and very appropriately, men and women both use both strategies, as it were, both kind of control and cooperation, you could say. But actually, I would say both of those are sources of power. The ability to get a group to agree and kind of, hey guys, let's all go do this. Or the ability to have a group look to you and say, no, I'm going to follow this person. It's not that one is power and the other isn't, or that boys and men seek power and girls and women don't. It's that they seek it through different pathways. Mm-hmm. But we're all made to have power, men and women, I think. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. And actually one of the gifts of being male and female is that we have different instincts about how to use power that need to be brought together to actually fruitfully do things together in the world. Mm-hmm. We actually both need the instincts that men tend to bring and the instincts that women tend to bring for really fruitful collaboration.
Gorgeous. That makes me just more excited about my own marriage, thinking about how my wife and I can work together to use our respective instincts and differentiated skill sets to both be powerful in raising our girls and being a source of grace to the world.
Yes, I would love, it's something that sounds odd to say, but I would love for everyone to ask, how can I have more power? Not necessarily more domination, not more control necessarily, but how can I have more power? Because really, another way of putting that is, how can I increase the amount of flourishing in the world? This is not the way we're taught to think about it, I think we think, boy, if I had more power, I'd probably mess things up. And you might, but that's the risk that comes with investing in other people's flourishing.
I feel like for young adults, for many young people, one inhibitor to taking on a healthy view of power and even asking for more of it in that godly way is a lack of forgiveness for those who have misused it.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
Spot on. We have all suffered because other people have misused power, either directly in our own lives or more broadly in the social systems that we're a part of. And some of us suffer from that more than others. I mean, there are histories to the use of power. Mm-hmm. And so I'm a white man. In some ways, I have avoided some of the worst effects of the way power has been misused. Mm-hmm. But then others have kind of experienced the full brunt of that. And until we've dealt with that, we will constantly be reacting to our own suffering, the way that we've been abused or we've witnessed abuse, sometimes have perpetrated. A really important mentor of mine said something very transformative to me years ago. He said, Andy, the trustees of an institution are those who have forgiven it. Now, I realize when you're young, you don't probably really want to be a trustee. You don't really want to be part of institutions. But I know that every human being has to forgive the institutions they were part of, starting with our own family. And an institution, by the way, is just a cultural pattern that lasts for multiple generations. And so we all start in an institution called the family, and every institution fails its members in some way. But then we join other institutions. We go to school, and say you had a pretty happy family when you were a little munchkin, then you go off to kindergarten, or for my kids, it was like seventh and eighth grade, and people are so mean. And like the school really, my kids got so cynical about these anti-bullying things, because they're like, the school isn't doing anything to stop bullying. It's very hard to stop bullying. What do you do with the failure of your institutions?
Yeah.
You have to forgive it, actually. And until you've forgiven those institutions for failing you and people you love, you're actually not in a position to start creatively using power within them. And this is different, by the way, also from denying that there's failure. And that's part of the power of forgiveness, is it actually says, I was failed. My parents failed me in certain ways. My church failed me. And I'm not going to deny that or cover that up. Instead, I'm going to name it, and then I'm going to release it to God. And then I'm free in a way that I wasn't before.
Beautiful.
So once you've gone through that process and you're ready to exert your power, where's the line of being an image bearer and also then playing God, as your book talks? I mean, I'm not sure if that's what you meant by the title, but how can you tell the difference and kind of navigate that for your own life?
Right. We talk about playing God usually as if it's something bad. You don't want to do that. I don't want to play God here. But I actually think the question is not, are you playing God, but which God are you playing? So there is a true God, a true creator God, but then there are also false gods in this world. And the temptation is to play a false God. How do we recognize false gods? Well, if I could sum it up in one word, false gods promise us control. And the true God, even in the story of creation in Genesis 1, is strangely uninterested in control. There's this word that shows up a couple times in the creation story where the world is teeming, sometimes it's translated teeming or swarming with creatures. And a world that's full of teeming and swarming is not a world that God sort of narrowly micromanages. Instead, the creator God, the true God, wants a world that flourishes. And he's willing to take a lot of risks and open up a lot of options for that world to flourish. Mm. Idols, which is our name for false gods, promise us that there's a better way to be God than the real God. And that way involves taking control over the world and using it to extract benefit for myself. When you think about the ancient gods that people used to worship, not the true God, they all made bargains. The god wanted something and I wanted something. And so I give the god what the god wants, some kind of worship, you know, maybe a sacrifice of some kind. And then I hope that I'll get what I want in return. The true God doesn't act like that. So here's how this applies to our power. When I have power, am I in it to make a bargain with people where I get control over them and I get what I want and I kind of give them what they want? Or do I make, this is more the true God, a covenant with them? Mm. That is, I'm now unconditionally for these people. So I lead a team, help to lead a team at the place where I work. And as a leader, I can either be in it for myself and I can start micromanaging and controlling the people I lead, or I can say, think much more covenantally and think, I'm here so that the people I lead will flourish. And I just trust that as they flourish, you know, I will flourish as well. So the question is, which God are you playing? And then, of course, you have to get to know the true God and be made into his image so that when you have that power, you play the true God rather than a false God.
In your book, you talked about how the spiritual disciplines and also practicing Sabbath are important parts of preparing you to be a person who can manage power well. Tell us more about that.
The interesting thing is, for us creatures, but maybe for the Creator God too. I mean, the Creator God took a Sabbath. The Creator God finishes creation and then he sits down and has this seventh day of enjoying what he's made. And we as creatures, for sure, need times when we rest. Really what Sabbath is about, this principle of taking a day a week where you don't work, is it's a day when you don't exert your power to provide for yourself. And you remember, there's this other reality in my world, the maker of my world, who has provided for me, will provide for me. And so one day a week, I practice the reality that I'm not my own self-provider. And again, the purpose of all of this is to train us to play the true God rather than false gods that say you've got to work all the time. You have to, whatever you get, you'll have to earn it. That's not the world we actually live in. The world we live in is a world of grace, abundance, gift, mercy. And once a week, you really have to make sure you are stepping back and just practicing that. And the way you do it is by not doing anything that provides for yourself. So if you're a student, your work is to study. So you don't study one day a week. Now, I have found very, very few Americans have any idea how to do this. And early on, especially if we're sort of ambitious and want to make the most of our opportunities, we think, well, you got to work 7 days a week. How could, you know, I have to do my homework on Sunday nights. And I will just say, in college, I decided I was going to take this seriously. I was not going to work on Sundays. I was the only person I knew, including in my whole Christian fellowship, who did this. And the only thing I would say was the most blessed experience, except for one thing. It was lonely because all my friends were working on Sundays. If they'd been willing to take the Sabbath, we could have done what the people of Israel did. Feast, celebrate, worship, play, go out, have fun. We're made to rest, not just to work. And if we don't know how to rest, I don't think we're safe with whatever work we're given. And the easiest time to develop these disciplines is when you're young, because the responsibilities just pile up the older you get. But I still take one full day off a week, and I just don't work that day. I don't answer email. I don't look at email. Don't look at any screens. I just look at my neighbors and my family and the people in my church, and we worship and feast and play together. And that's the most amazing thing about being human, is we get to do this every single week.
That's pretty convicting for me, because my wife and I keep on talking about the Sabbath thing. It's actually like on our our shared calendar.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I find myself continually not really intentionally doing this and instead working. I feel like what you're saying, part of it is, in order to be trustworthy with power, we have to practice like active trust in God, and like devoting that time to God is really trusting Him with it.
Yes.
And so I'm sort of being convicted as we talk about this and just realizing, yes, like, I'm not really trusting you, God, that you can provide for me, because I can't even take a day just to spend time with you.
Yeah. And this is the other function of all the spiritual disciplines. Sabbath is one, fasting is another, prayer and solitude are others. Actually, they're just as important for what they reveal about us as for anything we accomplish or, you know, I do the same thing. I do manage to mostly keep the screens off, but I find all kinds of ways to obsess about my work, to be, you know, thinking about that when I seem like I'm listening to someone. And actually what the disciplines do is they uncover how self-dependent we are. And that actually is part of becoming dependent on God. So the point is not to do the discipline perfectly. It's to attempt it. And then as you attempt it, to kind of learn, oh, that's where my real idol is. That's what I look to for satisfaction, for a sense of identity and security. You'll never find that out if you don't take that discipline. If you're just a workaholic all the time, you'll never know what an idol work is in your life. But if you rest and suddenly find yourself compelled to check that screen or to work on that one little thing, now you know how powerful it is. Wow. And now you can depend on God to rescue you from it.
It's good.
I think your book is a good reminder that of the potential we have as His image bearers, yet also recognizing that we're not God.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess just to take advantage of that in different ways, and your book covered a lot of different parts, but I think we have to remember the fact that we're not God in all of this as well.
Yeah, that's why maybe the most deep discipline for power of any kind, and again, we all have it. We all have some measure of ability to do something in the world and to make something of the world. The deepest discipline is worship. Because in worship, I can be set free of having to be my own God. And instead I can realize this power that I've been given, it's just a gift. I actually didn't ask for it. I didn't ask to be born. I didn't ask to be given many of the advantages I've had that have allowed me to acquire certain kinds of power. It's all gift. It's all very soon going to be handed back over to the one who made me. And that's actually the safest and most joyful place to be. If we do not worship the true God, we will end up either trying to become a false God ourselves, or we'll give ourselves over to things and people that aren't really God and that will promise great things, just this little contract that you have to make, and will actually end up deeply exploiting us and distorting our lives. So worship is where true power actually starts.
Well, Andy, thank you so much for taking the time from the conference and for sitting in this hot car to talk with us. And just thank you for kind of guiding us through a discussion of the importance of power and having a good theology of it, a good practice of it, and embrace of it in a way that can bring, you know, kind of spread God's glory. So yeah, Boundless People, check out Playing God by Andy Crouch. Awesome book. Just like the wind you blew right.
Folks, as we wrap up this show, we are going to go to our inbox, and I have Christina Browning from our counseling department. Hey, Christina.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, it's going well. Good to have you.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. This is like getting over a crush, someone that you like but doesn't seem to be showing interest. How in the world do we do it? So let me go ahead and read her question. I'm a young woman in my later 20s, and I've liked a godly Christian young man for the better part of 19 months. I love how she's so specific. The better part of 19 months.
Yes.
Even though it's clear he isn't interested in more than friendship. He moved away a few months ago, and there has been no communication between us, yet I still have unwanted feelings for him. Do you have any advice on getting over a crush?
Yes. Crushes are so
hard. Maybe
from
personal experience. Yeah.
Right? You know, I tell people it's not bad to have a crush. Like, you like the qualities in that person that you someday want in a mate, and it's okay to have that crush. It's not, it gets unhealthy when you get to a point where you're fantasizing and just not being able to separate the qualities that you are attracted to and separate those from the actual person. And so being able to acknowledge, hey, these are the qualities in a spouse that I'm really attracted to. You might even write them down so that you know what they are, but to separate them from the person. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? And mm-hmm. So one of the resources I've gone through and have other people gone through is Finding the Right One for You by Norman Wright. It's a book that really kind of helps you identify what are those qualities, and when you can acknowledge and say, it's okay for me to be attracted to and want this type of person, but separate it from the person. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah. And to not say, I think it's easy for us when we latch on to that one person to say, this is the only person in the world that has these qualities.
Right.
And you have to recognize that, no, there are many great qualities in a number of different people who could be potential matches.
Right. And when you're so focused on that one person and thinking, oh, well, he's the only one for me, or you're constantly keeping that person in your mind, you're preventing yourself from finding other people, and you're also putting a separation in allowing God to be God. Mm-hmm. And so to be able to kind of acknowledge and say, okay, Lord, these are the desires of my heart, and then turn it back to the Lord and say, Lord, you know me. I want this, and mm-hmm. really allow him to fill the needs in your heart and meet the desires of your heart, because God has promised to do so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's good. I would say just straight up practical, from my own experience. First off, if you were really and are really attached to this guy, 3 months is not that long of a time. I mean, it depends on how long you've allowed this relationship to build up in your head and stuff.
Right.
So give it time. Right. I always say time. You will not forever be obsessed with this guy.
Right.
It will fade. Also, I know you say there's been no communication between you. I want to also bring up the point that this also means that you need to not do the one-way communication. You need to not be stalking him on Facebook, be asking your mutual friends about him. It's very easy for us to kind of play that role of keeping tabs on people, and we think, well, it's okay because I'm not talking to him.
Right.
Well, you don't need to be following his life either. He's moved away. You said he's clearly not interested in anything besides friendship.
Right.
You really do need to free up your own heart and your own attention and time for mm-hmm. whoever else might come along.
Absolutely, because you're creating that fantasy relationship in your head, and that's unhealthy.
Yeah.
And that blocks you from being open to other relationships. So really try and limit that as much as possible.
Yeah. Great thoughts, Christina. Thank you so much for
weighing in. Thank you.
Okay, folks, that is it for this week's show. Write to us at editor@boundless.org with any question you have, including a question for the inbox, or any questions you may have about Boundless and our ministry, where we're going from here, what's up. Please be telling your friends about us, because really that's the way that other folks will get on board with what we are doing here and to understand really a godly framework for growing up, owning your faith, and dating with purpose, and ultimately preparing for marriage and family. So we will see you next week. Until then, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org, focused on the family.